Coming up in the next hour on Morning Ireland, what could be a life-saving development, the research on an Ebola vaccine on which test results so far are described as promising. Transport Minister Pascal Donoghue on closing a loophole in drink driving law, some tips for shopping safely online, and back to politics. The economy is picking up, the Troika have gone home, so does the government still need its inner or upper cabinet, the Economic Management Council? That's in the next 60 minutes.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Thursday, November 27th. This is Morning Ireland with Cathal McCullia and Audrey Carville.
The news headlines. The HSE is publishing its service plan today that will address waiting lists and cancer care services. Laws are coming into force aimed at strengthening road safety and penalising traffic offenders. The first human trial of an experimental vaccine against Ebola suggests that it may help the immune system to fight the virus. And experts warn that climate change and population growth will increase the risks of people being affected by extreme weather. The news in full from Brian Jennings.
The Health Service Executive is to publish its service plan for 2015 today, setting out the type and volume of services it will provide. It's expected to include measures to reduce hospital waiting lists and additional funding for mental health and suicide prevention services. Joan O'Sullivan reports.
The Cabinet gave approval on Tuesday for the HSE's services plan for next year to be published today. The plan sets out the extent of services the HSE will provide directly and through a range of funded agencies in 2015. It's expected to include specific measures to tackle waiting lists, with the recruitment of hundreds of extra frontline staff. Cancer services are also to be expanded. It's understood the plan includes total savings of €130 million, with cuts to spending on drugs and agency staff. In last month's budget, the health service was allocated its first funding increase for 7 years. However, it's thought much of that increase will be absorbed by this year's spending overrun.
From today, blood samples can legally be taken from motorists injured in accidents without their consent. The measure is part of a tightening of road safety legislation coming into force. The introduction of the new laws coincides with the start of the Christmas and New Year road safety campaign. Sinead Hussey reports.
The measures being introduced today will see the closure of a legal loophole, which allowed drunken drivers to avoid blood tests through being unconscious or by claiming injury. Under the new rules, medical authorities may now take a sample from a driver who is unable to provide consent to the procedure. A driver will be asked on regaining capacity whether they consent to the issuing of a certificate of the test results based on the sample. The certificate stating the level of alcohol in the bloodstream may be used in a subsequent prosecution. If the driver refuses to allow the sample to be used, the refusal will be an offence, and penalties can include disqualification from driving. Gardaí are also been given additional powers to allow for roadside testing for drugs. Drivers can now be asked to perform a range of balance and coordination movements, which may indicate if they've been driving while under the influence of drugs.
Scientists have said that the first human trial of an experimental vaccine against Ebola suggests that it is safe and may help the immune system to combat the virus. 20 healthy volunteers in the United States were immunised in the trial. None suffered noticeable side effects. One of the scientists involved in the trial, Dr. Anthony Fauci, described the initiative as a crucial first step in finding an effective vaccine.
On safety and on the ability to induce an appropriate response, I think we can call this vaccine trial an unqualified success. Even though it's an early phase one trial, it clearly was successful.
A study has warned that the incidence of life-threatening heat waves could increase more than tenfold by the end of the century as a result of global warming. The study by the Royal Society in Britain also forecasts that extreme rainfall could lead to a fourfold risk of exposure to flooding. Our science and technology correspondent, Will Goodbody.
The study adopts a worst-case scenario, assuming an increase in average global temperatures of up to 4.8 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. The scientists calculate the impact of both climate and population changes on the chances of people being affected by floods, droughts and heat waves in parts of Europe like Ireland, where population densities are increasing and the population ageing, heat waves are found to be the most serious threat. The report also finds a dramatically increased risk of exposure to flooding in parts of Western Europe, while the threat of drought hung over the Mediterranean. It issues an urgent call to both governments and private companies to do more to address extreme weather hazards. The experts recommend engineering be combined with natural approaches like re-establishing floodplains and planting vegetation. The scientists also warn that unless companies improve the way they handle weather risks, their credit ratings could suffer.
An Australian cricketer, Philip Hughes, has died 2 days after he was hit on the head by a ball while batting during a game in Sydney. He was 25. Hughes had been placed in an induced coma after emergency surgery to relieve pressure on his brain, but he never regained consciousness. Now the time is coming up to 6 minutes past eight.
It's time for It Says in the Papers with Caroline Murphy.
Reforms may make 2,000 eligible for adoption. That's the headline across the front of the Irish Times this morning. Carl O'Brien reports that while domestic adoptions of children in state care are rare, planned changes to the law are likely to make it much easier to adopt those who've been in long-term foster care for 3 years. We're told there are more than 6,500 children in foster care here and that the impact of the proposed changes will be discussed at a conference today. The impact of proposed changes on those who groom children online, meanwhile, makes the lead in the Irish Examiner. Offender Bill to Protect Children Online is the headline, under which we're told the grooming of children for sex abuse or exploitation will be a criminal offence under draft laws to be published today. And the lead story in the Irish Independent is on our children too, though it's from the parents' point of view. Parents will get report card on how schools rate is the headline, as the paper reports on plans we're told are being drawn up by the Department of Education. Catherine Donnelly says there's a growing acceptance that parents must be provided with an accurate picture of the strengths and weaknesses of schools. She tells us the reports could cover everything from teaching standards and student achievement to how well schools look after pupils' health and well-being, but that critically, it's unlikely that they will include exam results. Health stories get prominence today. The Irish Daily Mail leads with the case of a woman who is asking for access to a particular drug. How can they let me die is the headline directed at the HSE there. The Examiner has a front page story on an inquest into the death of a young man in Limerick in 2013. Doctor first saw a very urgent A&E patient when he was found dead on trolley is the headline on that one. Well, the Times has a piece on the HSE's plans. HSE to target waiting times and cancer care. We're told, as you heard in the bulletin, that the organisation's service plan is to be published today. How the new Garda Commissioner will deal with her organisation remains to be seen, but her appointment gets commented upon in a number of papers today. In The Times, former Chief Superintendent John O'Brien writes about what he sees as the key issues for the Garda Commissioner's in-tray. In The Examiner, Michael Clifford says that while Noreen O'Sullivan has had luck on her side, she'll have to perform her new role under greater scrutiny than any of her predecessors have faced. And in The Mail, Roslyn D has advice on it all for us. Don't cheer, she says, because there's a woman at the head of Don Garda Síochána. Cheer only if she's right for the job. The job figures and employment get attention meanwhile today. Unemployment rate at lowest level since 2009 is the headline at the top story in the business and technology section in The Times. And a piece on page 19 of The Independent is headline, Noonan hails jobs turnaround as numbers in work hits 5-year high. Otherwise, this morning, there's plenty about mortgages. The Independent finds front page space for a report on the news that householders will not need a 20% deposit from the 1st of January because the central bank won't meet its own deadline to enforce the new rule. We're told that as he admitted the plans were being pushed back, Patrick Honohan also warned that house price jumps could sow the seeds of trouble for the future unless a new regime is in place. In a comment piece inside, meanwhile, Thomas Molloy says of Honohan himself, he has two masters who want completely different things. Michael Noonan wants the property party to continue indefinitely, while the European Central Bank wants the opposite, a responsible housing policy that would choke off the bubble. But finally this morning, should Don Delaney have choked off the singing? A couple of letter writers to the Times expressed sympathy for the FAI boss, pointing out that other lyrics in other songs were happy to sing. But Michael Cullen has only tongue-in-cheek admiration for him. "Sir," writes Cullen, "John Delaney is undoubtedly a remarkable football man. Who else could shoot themselves in the foot and score an own goal while blatantly offside?"
Welcome back. You're listening to Morning Ireland at 13 minutes past eight. Until now, somebody who was stopped by the Gardaí on suspicion of drink driving could refuse to consent to provide a blood specimen for testing as to their alcohol level. But that's about to change. In fact, it's changing today. This comes as the Road Safety Campaign for Christmas and the New Year is launched by the Gardaí, the Road Safety Authority, and Transport Minister Pascal Donoghue joins us now. You're welcome.
Good morning, Cathal.
Now, this is a loophole which is gone. Is it gone now? As we speak?
Yes, it will be.
And what is it? What's the new position?
Well, Cathal, this deals specifically with the issue of people who are driving while impaired with the presence of drugs in their system. And we have an organisation here in Ireland called the Medical Bureau of Road Safety that one of their main jobs is to analyse the specimens of blood and urine that are provided to them by the Gardaí where there is suspicion of the presence of intoxicants in the system. And their figures show that between 2007 and 2013, for the 10,500 samples of blood and urine that they analysed, drugs were present in 7,200 of those samples, so in over 70% of it. And furthermore, work that was undertaken by the coroner in Kildare indicated that between 1998 and 2009, 1 in 10 drivers who lost their lives had drugs in their system. So for all of these reasons, what we're now moving to a system is where we will have impairment testing in place that would deal with the issue of the presence of drugs
within the system.
Now, impairment
testing is what?
There'll be five different tests in place. What they will do is they will look at issues like the state of your pupils. There'll be a balance test. There'll be a walk and turn test, standing on one leg, and then a finger to nose test. We have done extensive training and the Gardaí have done extensive training in relation to the implementation of this testing, and it builds on success that we have seen of these tests in some states in America and then in European countries like Belgium, where they have been very, very successful in dealing with the issue of the presence of drugs and the impairment that it causes to drivers.
But back to the blood test, which is, I take it, you mentioned intoxicants, it's for drink, alcohol as well?
Correct.
And if you refuse now?
Well, you're required to provide that sample. You're required to provide, what happens is two samples are provided. The samples are taken by a doctor or a nurse and they are then sent to the Medical Bureau of Road Safety where the analysis takes place. And what we are doing now is we are supporting that with this impairment test. And what will then happen, Cathal, is I'm currently drafting a new piece of road safety legislation that will then look at bringing in devices that will be specifically designed to test for the presence of drugs in the system of a driver, like we have at the moment in relation to alcohol.
Yeah, but the position until now was that the option of consenting or refusing to provide a specimen was there. From now on?
No, you are required to provide that specimen.
You are required to provide that specimen. But you had to consent to its use.
Well, the specific case there was that if you were brought in, if an accident happened and a person was brought into a hospital unconscious and that person was the driver, okay? The driver, previously, there was no system in place in which a blood sample could be taken from an unconscious driver if they went into hospital. What now happens is specifically in the case of an incident or accident, the law has now been changed that when a person goes into hospital, they're driving, a serious accident has taken place, the Gardaí can request the consent of the doctor to take a blood sample. That is taken by another doctor. When the person becomes conscious, their consent is required. They have to give that consent.
And if they refuse?
Then those samples are tested. No, they must require. Under current road safety legislation, you must give your consent for the testing of blood. And what we are now doing is make that consistent for people who are on the side of a road or for somebody who becomes conscious.
So basically the position from now as we speak is that everybody who is stopped by the Gardaí on suspicion of drink driving or driving under the influence of intoxicants or drugs, they'll all have to give a test, and that test will, if it's above the limit, will be used in court.
The core message here really is that driving while under the influence of drugs poses a threat to yourself and to other people. if we just look at those figures again, that over 70% of the samples that were tested by the Medical Bureau of Road Safety indicated the presence of intoxicants, one in 10 drivers who died in Kildare over a 10-year period had the presence of drugs within their system. The one point I would want to emphasise is in relation to prescription drugs. And Professor Dennis Cusack, who heads up the Medical Bureau of Road Safety, has made the point, and I want to emphasise this, that if somebody is using prescription drugs, and they're using those drugs in a way that has been prescribed to them by their doctor or by their pharmacist, there's nothing to fear with that. They will pass the impairment test as long as you're using those drugs in the way that are prescribed.
Well, but just to be clear about this, you're saying this, the loophole is gone. That means that everybody tested by the Gardaí who's over the limit and the presence of either drugs or excessive amounts of alcohol is detected, everybody must give it a sample, and that sample will be used in court. There's no way out.
Well,
they
must give a sample. As to whether it will be used in court or not will obviously depend on the analysis that is carried out by the Medical Bureau of Road Safety.
Yeah, but
because that will then lead to a presence of drugs. So but what we
there
are
is do- it just is there any loophole left?
No, I mean the whole purpose of this was to look at the issue in relation to how drug testing and impairment testing is conducted, based on the feedback that we have received from the Gardaí, and also based on the independent statistics that I have shared with you. I was satisfied that this issue needed to be dealt with. I have now dealt with it. The Gardaí are now trained in the implementation of it and will form a core part of an advertising campaign from the Road Safety Authority, and then all of the presence and security and the Garda detection points that will be in place across
Britain. We'll hear more from you later today and from the Garda and the Road Safety Authority about a situation which is, I mean, obviously the warnings for Christmas and New Year are obvious, and the need, given the figures are going the wrong way in terms of deaths on the
roads. And can I just briefly emphasise that point too? I mean, this is all part of our broader campaign in relation to road safety. Too many people continue to lose their lives on our road. 15% of people who have lost their lives on the road were not wearing seatbelts. And the purpose of this campaign overall, which I'm launching with Liz O'Donnell, the new chairperson of the Road Safety Authority, and our new Garda Commissioner, Noreen O'Sullivan, is to emphasise the need to everybody to please be careful on the road across Christmas.
More on that during the day. Minister, I just want to ask you about a view about your leader, the Taoiseach, from a former government minister writing in the Irish Independent, Ivan Yates, this morning, who's talking about something which obviously no one in the party can be happy with in Fine Gael, what happened with Irish Water, and saying that the Taoiseach's judgment and authority have been held below the waterline by the Irish Water situation, and saying that because he's involved in things like the Economic Management Council and so on, which we'll hear about in a moment, senior civil servants, ministers and so on, he's in the bunker and won't, by people, according to Ivan Yates, who won't ever tell him to his face, that he's become part of the problem rather than the solution. Now, in the context of the Irish Water debacle, isn't there a question mark about Enda Kenny's leadership?
No, there is not. I could not see a leader who's further out of the bunker than the Taoiseach. We've seen yesterday the figures that show that our unemployment rate is at the lowest level since 2009. And the Taoiseach and the measures that the government have taken, like a lower VAT rate, like what we have done to deliver funded tax reductions to people in the budget that has been passed at the moment, much of that is due to the leadership that the Taoiseach has delivered in Cabinet and beyond.
And so is the mess over the medical cards, and so is the mess over Irish Water. I mean, he's the top man.
But the Taoiseach has come out and acknowledged that. I mean, he's come out very clearly when required, when needed, to say, yes, there are things that he acknowledges needed to be done differently. He has fixed them. I'm privileged to be a member of the Cabinet. I see the Taoiseach's openness to diverse views every day. I see the extraordinary work rate and effort that he puts into leading our Cabinet and our government. And as I said, we're out of a bailout programme. We've seen unemployment.
And still now making mistakes.
We're dealing with a variety of very, very challenging issues. Even though unemployment is at its lowest rate since 2009, we still have too many people who are out of work. We still have many pressing issues that need to be dealt with. But if you look at the core issues, for example, in relation to how we move our economy forward, in relation to, for example, political reform, the Taoiseach
problem is
instrumental
that's
in
people are
making
They're annoyed about medical cards, they're annoyed about water.
Can I just touch on the water piece? I mean, if you look, I have acknowledged and will do so again that too much was done too quickly in relation to that. If you look at the package that was brought out in relation to that, to give certainty and clarity to what costs will be, to put measures in place to make sure that they will be affordable, the Taoiseach has been instrumental in making that happen.
Just a final question about the Economic Management Council, this inner cabinet. You're not a member of it, of course. We'll be hearing about this in a moment. But how do you see it as an outsider? I mean, it's some people have said it's secretive, it's maybe unconstitutional, according to some people. It certainly means that the big decisions are made not by you and your colleagues in government, but by the four people in this council.
But this unit,
do you have any reservations about it at all?
No, I don't. I mean, this unit of governance that we see here is similar to what we see in many other European countries and abroad, where they have units and teams of ministers in place to deal with issues that cut across government. We've many other cabinet subcommittees that I'm on that deal with issues that affect many people. For example, the Cabinet Committee on Infrastructure. Yeah. And in relation to your specific point, what I see happen is I see proposals that come into cabinet from different subcommittees of the cabinet that are debated, and then most of them are agreed. But I believe if you look at the role and how unemployment has fallen, in how we've left our bailout programme, and the fact that we now have the fastest growing economy in Europe, I believe the Taoiseach and the role of the EMC in relation to that have been instrumental in making both happen.
Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Transport, thank you very much. 8:23.
More on that Economic Management Council. It was set up at the height of the economic crisis when the current government came to power in 2011, and its members are the Taoiseach, the Tánaiste, the Finance Minister and the Minister for Public Expenditure. They meet regularly to discuss and decide key questions of economic policy, but it has many critics. Petula Martin reports.
Many people feel that a coup d'etat has taken place inside this government, that the Economic Management Council has seized all powers to itself.
My questions relate to the Economic Management Council, and many people are concerned that there are more advisors and members of government attend that and speak at this very, very powerful council. And there's fundamental questions to be asked in terms of the constitutionality of it, in my view.
Joe Higgins and Micheál Martin raising concerns in the Dáil about the Economic Management Council. It was set up under extraordinary economic circumstances, but with an improving economy, is there still a case for the EMC? Former Tánaiste Michael McDool.
The government is answerable to Dáil Éireann as the government, not as a subcommittee of government. So in those circumstances, I think that it is subversive of constitutional values to keep it in existence now, whatever excuse was given for having it while the Troika were here.
Labour's Éan Ó'Riordán, recently appointed a Minister of State, says Ireland still faces economic challenges. He's in favour of keeping the EMC.
These are extreme times, extremely testing times, economically, socially and every other way in Ireland. And we need to have that focus from the Economic Management Council. And again, it needs to be split parity of esteem between the two parties of government.
Previous governments have faced testing times as well, and they didn't have an Economic Management Council. They had a collective cabinet decision-making process. Why this government? Why now?
Because we've never had an economic meltdown like this one. We've never had in the history of our state a mess comparable to the economic situation we found ourselves in. We've never had the IMF in here before. We never had to deal with the Troika. We never had the level of national debt before.
Minister for Agriculture Simon Coveney says the EMC helps maintain cohesion between the coalition parties.
The role of the EMC primarily is about keeping a strong and positive and mutually respectful relationship between two different parties in government. I think that is the main value of it. And I think it's served both Labour and Fine Gael well in that context in terms of the relationship that has been maintained through, let's face it, a very difficult period in government.
During that difficult period in government, John Walsh was a special advisor to then Minister for Education, Rory Quinn. He gives the example of a proposal by the Department of Education, which was rejected by the EMC.
One that was discussed, to my knowledge, at that council was the question of the possibility of worsening the pupil-teacher ratio at primary level. And we had very reluctantly in education proposed a worsening of the pupil-teacher ratio at primary level. But the EMC, which at the time comprised three teachers and one other minister, the Tánaiste, who wasn't a teacher, decided no, this would not happen. So that obviously had to go back to Cabinet for final sign-off, but the Cabinet was certainly not going to disagree with the four most powerful ministers in the Cabinet.
Michael McDool questions another decision made by the EMC, the decision to impose spending limits on health estimates.
One of the things that concerned me quite a lot was when it became clear that the Minister for Health, Dr. James Riley, really wasn't in charge of developing the estimates and putting together the estimates for consideration each year by the Dáil, as the Constitution requires. Instead, he was being just given spending limits and told that he would have to work out in his own way by undetermined measures how he would live within those estimates. And I believe that that whole process whereby the Economic Management Council just handed him out a maximum figure and then said, you run the health system within that figure, that is not what the Constitution requires of government.
The Economic Management Council is a place where a relatively small number of people can get around a table and try to figure out solutions to sometimes very difficult and awkward problems.
But is that not the role of Cabinet to make those decisions? And do you not feel you're rubber stamping decisions that have been made at the EMC when you're a Cabinet Minister? You have a role to play in those decisions.
No, I don't. The Cabinet does make the decisions, but the EMC often brings proposals and compromises. Sometimes those compromises are pretty well thought out by the time they come to Cabinet, but it is the Cabinet that makes the decisions. There's nothing to stop individual ministers objecting, and that has happened at times.
It is demeaning for other ministers who are not part of the Economic Management Council to find that decisions have been made effectively behind their back without their being given an opportunity to discuss the issues and to have their input. Either you are a member of government or you're not.
The myth and the allegations surrounding the Economic Management Council, that this is some quartet that makes all the decisions for government, is nothing other than a myth.
When I was Taoiseach, I would meet with the Taoiseach before Cabinet meetings just to go through what was coming up on the Cabinet agenda and to see were we all singing from the same hymn sheet between the two parties in government. But there wasn't a sense that there was an inner group of people making the economic decisions which the other people just had to rubber stamp. And I think that that's an undesirable development.
Well, if that's what Michael McDougall said, it sounds like he did have an EMC of sorts, except it was just an informal arrangement. This is just sounds like a slightly more formal version of that. You know, I mean, I think Michael McDougall is looking to judge this government in the context of the way in which the government that he was previously part of worked or didn't work. And I think it's always difficult to judge from the outside.
Agriculture and Defence Minister Simon Coveney ending that report on the Economic Management Council by Petula Martin.
Des Cahill is back with the sport and obviously sad news on the morning of Phil Hughes. And a reminder about, we were just talking here about the weight of a cricket ball. It's like no other sporting ball what's it like?
A hockey ball, well, it's big and it's very heavy. And obviously very powerful. This is for people who are joining late. The news that Australian Test batsman Phil Hughes has died 2 days after being hit on the head by a ball. He would have been 26 on Sunday. Very young man, and it was horrific. I mean, the pictures, a lot of people have seen the pictures. Like, he collapsed face first into the ground after being hit. Now, he was hit behind the ear and above the neck, going back to your point, with a bouncer, which is kind of an aggressive ball, but the helmet didn't cover that particular area. And we were just saying earlier, for those who'd wondered why, apparently if the helmet was to cover it right down that area to the neck, it would restrict movement and possibly cause other injuries as well. That's why it didn't cover there. But it does pose questions. Two young cricketers died last year, actually. I was just talking, one in South Africa struck on the side of the head, and one in Pakistan was struck in the chest by a cricket ball. There have been a few deaths from the ball hitting somebody in the chest as well, with the power and pace of it. So it is a very, very dangerous ball, obviously, if not. Now, Phil Hughes is an international class batsman and would be used to trying to avoid it. It was really a freak accident. Now, many tributes are being paid to him as we speak in Australia. Here's Cricket Australia's James Sutherland.
Without doubt, he was a rising star whose best cricket was still ahead of him. Hughesy, Huey, or Hugh Dog, as he was known to many of his mates, was much loved. You only have to sift through the thousands of messages of support, prayers and well wishes for Philip from cricketers and supporters all over the world to understand the affection felt towards him. He will forever be remembered as one of the elite few to have worn the baggy green cap, cap number 408 to be precise. He was a hero to kids around the nation, particularly those in the region around his hometown of Maxville in New South Wales. And he did them proud in his 26 test matches, a tally that looked certain to grow, but now, sadly, never will. The national selectors had certainly identified him as having a long-term future in the game. It was only a few days ago when announcing the first test team for the forthcoming Indian series that national selector Rod Marsh said, "He's a hell of a good batsman. He's a very, very good young player who's got 26 first-class hundreds." We all vividly remember his explosive entrance to test cricket. In 2009, in only his second test and at the tender age of 20, Philip blasted back-to-back centuries against South Africa. And only last year, he showed his class again when he became the first Australian batsman in the history of one-day cricket to score a century on debut. But it was Philip as a person that we will miss most. He was a classic example of his country upbringing, humble, understated, and hard-working. When the chips were down or he had a setback, he simply got on with the job and worked harder. He set a wonderful example to any young person seeking to make their way in life.
It's very sad. And the young bowler as well, Marissa thought, he's only 22 and he's receiving counselling at the moment. It's just a dreadful story on so many levels, affecting a lot of people. Now, we're staying in Australia because in golf, Rory McIlroy is just two shots off the lead after the opening round of the Australian Open Golf. He's the defending champion. He's two under par after an opening round of 69. The leader on four under is the American Jordan Spieth. Now, last night's Champions League action was disappointing for Liverpool fans. They conceded a late goal to draw 2-2 away to Ludogorets. However, because Basel were beaten at home by the group winners Real Madrid, Liverpool can still qualify from the group if they win their last game at home to Basel on December the 9th. Ricky Lambert and Jordan Henderson scored the Liverpool goals last night. In Group D, Arsenal beat Borussia Dortmund by 2-0 to qualify along with Dortmund for the knockout stages. It's the 15th consecutive season that Arsenal have reached the last 16. It's some achievement. Goals from Sonogo and Alexis Sanchez last night. The other teams who definitely qualified from last night: Atletico Madrid, Real Madrid and Bayer Leverkusen. In tonight's Europa League action, Celtic are at home to Red Bull Salzburg. Tottenham host Partizan Belgrade. Everton go to Wolfsburg. The FAI board has come out strongly in defence of their chief executive John Delaney, saying they're happy to bring the recent controversy to a close and confirmed they have given him a contract extension until the year 2020. Fergal O'Brien was beaten 6-4 by the Brazilian Igor Figueiredo in the first round of the UK Snooker Championship in York last night. Louth man John Sutton lost 6-0 to Ding Junhui, and Gerard Green won his match. Ken Doherty's in action at 9:30 this morning. Three more high-profile retirements in Gaelic games. Two Kilkenny legends, Brian Hogan and Aidan Fogarty, who between them have won 15 All-Ireland titles. And Tipperary forward John O'Brien also announced he is quitting. Mark English was named Ireland's Athlete of the Year after a brilliant summer when the Donegal man won bronze in the men's 800 metres final at the European Championships. And in racing, Tony McCoy made a winning return from his injury at Fontwell yesterday. And the big focus in today's racing at Thurles is the appearance of Willie Mullins' Unde So over hurdles. Already unbeaten in 9 races, he goes in the opening race at 12:20.
To the HSE's new service plan, which will be published today. The Irish Times reports that the plan will include measures to tackle waiting lists, expand cancer services and recruit hundreds of extra doctors and nurses, but will also include savings totalling €130 million to come from cuts in spending on drugs, procurement, agency staff and clinical audit. For reaction ahead of the details, but given the expressions already by the Minister for Health of the need to deal with problems on waiting lists, we're joined by Liam Doran, General Secretary of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Good morning.
Good morning, Carl.
Do you know what's in this plan? And insofar as you know, what do you think of it?
Well, no, we're getting a briefing at 11 o'clock this morning, so the fine detail will be outlined to us, but I think it's fairly well flagged now in terms of what was announced on Budget Day, in terms of the funding for the health service and what is possible. And then, obviously, via the bit-by-bit leaks as to the general trust behind the service plan, which in one sense has got to be welcome because it's the first time in years that we are not getting worse, that we're not cutting services, and that we're not suffering a real cut in budget allocation. But on the other hand, then, one has to have a strong sense of realism that the actual budget for this year, the actual spend this year, will almost match the allocation for next year. So that essentially we will be making things no worse, but we won't be able to do anything dramatic, I think, to tackle the continuing very black spots that face the health service and, more importantly, the patients that use it every day.
We heard earlier in the programme about a particularly worrying case described at the coroner's court in Limerick yesterday about somebody who was classed on arrival at A&E in the regional hospital, now known as the University Hospital, as a very urgent case and wasn't seen by a doctor for 3 hours. How severe is the A&E problem, and what's needed given the financial restraints to deal with it?
Well, Cathal, I mean, I know I sound like a record got stuck, but I actually and genuinely and completely feel no one in health management across the government understands the extent of the crisis that is a daily occurrence in a number of hospitals across the country with regard to emergency department overcrowding. We measured over 7,000 people on trolleys last month in October across the country. A number of those are particularly black spots, Limerick being one of them. The HICWA, the independent watchdog, last June said that it was unfit for purpose. Nothing has changed since then. Nothing. We called HICWA, asked them to go back in. They haven't got the resources to go back in. You have other black spots, Tullamore, Drogheda, Galway, other areas in Dublin, Beaumont. They're all black spots. And they've been black spots, Cathal, for almost 10 years. That's the thing that people forget. We get blasé about this. So you ask what is necessary. There's 25 million set aside in this service plan. That's better than nothing, but it's nothing like what is required. What is required is a significant expansion of continuing care beds. What is required is a significant expansion of community care and home supports so that the 800 people who are in hospital every day that have been clinically discharged can be taken to another area of the health service, all their needs still met in a quality assured way. You then free up those acute beds. We've got to address that problem, but that will not be addressed in the quantum that is required. Even though this service plan and this budget is obviously stabilizing it and making things no worse, we need a seismic leap forward to make the health service fit for purpose.
All right, Liam Dole, sorry,
that,
go on.
And that isn't there, but the government has to wake up and realise that's what's required to have a health service serve the community.
Liam Dolan of the INMO, thank you very much. Doran of the INMO, thank you very much. 16 minutes to 9.
You're welcome back to Morning Ireland. It's 12 minutes to 9. The first human trial of an experimental vaccine against Ebola suggests that it is safe and that it may help the immune system to combat the deadly virus. Since March, more than 5,000 people have died from Ebola in Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. We can talk now to Dr. Graham Fry, who is founder of the Tropical Medical Bureau. He's now its clinical director and he's on the line now. Dr. Fry, good morning.
Hi, good morning to you too.
What more can you tell us about this vaccine and what's happening in the trials?
Okay, well, we're still at a very early point in time. I mean, they've only tried it on 20 people at this point, so it's very, very small numbers of people who've actually been offered the vaccine to see does it produce the antibodies. Nevertheless, the actual response so far that has been reported is excellent. Now, it's been a very, very good response from those who've had it. So we're still at a very early stage, Audrey, and you have to go on now to the next stage of trying it on hundreds and hundreds of people, not just this small cohort that's been used so far.
So when, obviously depending on the results, but when might it be available for widespread use?
I think the figures that I've seen are at the end of 2015, so that's 12 months away at this point in time, before the vaccine is going to be easily available for the vast majority of people who actually need it, who are those who are actually living in the West African outbreak at the moment, and potentially other outbreaks that are occurring as well. But so it's a good while off yet. It's at least 6 to 12 months, that sort of time frame.
Is it being made too quickly?
That's a difficult question because obviously, like in 2009 when we had the swine flu problem, we had to have a vaccine very rapidly because swine flu was killing so many people. And actually, some people may remember back to the 1950s when we had exactly the same situation with the a polio outbreak, a huge polio outbreak in Dublin and Cork around that time, and in many other areas as well, obviously. And that vaccine was rushed too. So under certain circumstances, you have to get a vaccine out quickly because it's the lesser of the two evils. So yes, there will be some shortcuts taken. There'll be some safety protocols which will be put aside just to try and ensure that we have something to protect people. Because at this point in time, obviously, there isn't anything, which is one of the major difficulties in West Africa.
And presumably, if these trials yield positive results, then the vaccines will be offered to thousands of health workers across West Africa who are dealing with the Ebola virus. Is it known, though, how long the protection from the vaccine might last?
No, it's far too early. That has to come over the next 6 to 12 months. That's one of the things that will be looked at, the side effects of the vaccine, potentially the amount of cover it actually gives, what length of time it lasts for. Those are things that have to be looked into when you're actually producing any vaccine against any illness. And one of the things about it is just to bear in mind, vaccines are brilliant. They really do work very well, but they don't necessarily give 100% protection. So under those circumstances, if the vaccine is giving 80%, 90%, 95%, you still have to be careful. You still have to take all the normal precautions which are necessary to try and avoid infection transmission.
You can't become complacent, in other words.
No, not at all.
Absolutely.
No,
and
no, that's absolutely true.
In relation to your job as Clinical Director of the Tropical Medical Bureau, are you seeing or getting many calls from people who have returned to Ireland who've been in West Africa?
Yeah, we're seeing quite a number who are actually going to West Africa as part of one of the aid organisations, going to work out there. So they obviously need to be met and talked through. And they need to be covered against other illnesses, not forgetting that there's many other things that occur in that part of the world. And then we're getting the opposite, which is people coming back home into Ireland who have potentially been exposed. Most of the vast majority of the risk has been extremely small, obviously. But nevertheless, you need to make sure that they understand what to look out for over these coming days.
And that's all you can offer them, isn't it? Advice and that's it, really.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, don't forget, in the vast majority of cases, and that's foodborne disease, waterborne disease, mosquito-borne disease, doesn't really matter what disease, one of the best things is not to get the illness in the first place and what to look out for, so that if you do develop anything, that we can actually do something about it. We can care for the person and try and ensure that they're given the best possible care and avoid them passing on to other people as well.
Well, thank you very much indeed for talking to us on Morning Ireland. That's Dr. Graham Fry, who is the Clinical Director and Founder of the Tropical Medical Bureau. Now, the third level destination of thousands of Leaving Cert students is published today in newspapers. The so-called feeder schools for third level education lists how many students from each school went to each university or college. Meanwhile, according to the Irish Independent this morning, new plans are being drawn up by the Department of Education to give parents more information about how their child's school is performing. With us in studio, Brian Mooney, education analyst and guidance counsellor at Oatlands College in Dublin. Brian, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
In relation to the feeder schools tables this morning in the papers, is that, who do they relate to? Are they the Leaving Cert class just gone past, or who are they?
Absolutely not. Colleges provide the newspapers with the number of students from every school who registered with them in first year this year. And those figures go back to anyone who did the Leaving Cert after 1985. So if you actually look at the figures, the national figures which we get every year from the HEA and from the CAO, it's clear that about, of every 100 students that go to college, about 70 did the Leaving Cert this year in Ireland. About 22 did the Leaving Cert in that school at some stage previously. And about 8 students come from outside the country, 2 from the UK and Northern Ireland, 3 from Europe and 3 from the rest of the world. So there's your average 100 students. So what you're getting in the feeder tables this morning is, in a sense, the 92 students. But because we do not get the figures for the number who progressed from this year's Leaving Cert, they're always expressed in the newspapers as a percentage of last year's Leaving Cert class. So that's why you get the ludicrous statistics of 120% and 125%. It's 125% of last year's Leaving Cert class of all of those who went. So if a school, for instance, is growing very fast and therefore has a high proportion of this year's Leaving Certs, the progression rate may not be huge. But if the numbers were dropping, as we have in a number of schools, the percentages look ludicrous. There is an example which we give in the Irish Times this morning of a school that had 32 students in 2009, has 11 now, had 16 students went to university this year from that school, and therefore looks to have a progression rate of nearly 200%.
So it's all skewed.
It's all skewed in that sense.
Do they take into account students who go to third level abroad?
It doesn't. These are just the number of students. And students, obviously, we get about 2,000 students from the Republic go to UK and Northern Ireland every year. About 1,200 of them would be leaving cert, about 800 would be older.
They include Queen's University, do they?
Yes. Yeah. And effectively, if you look at the feeder schools list, you'll also find a lower percentage of success for students, for schools around the border counties. That's not because they've lower success. It's because a proportion of those are going to schools in Northern Ireland and they're not recorded. And we have a growing trend of students who are now going to European universities, because there's about 1,000 courses now being offered exclusively through English on much lower points because of the demographics in Europe. They're not recorded. We get people who go to the States on sports scholarships. They're not recorded.
So from the data that's there and what's available, what do you take from it?
Well, social class is still the predominant determinant of where you go after school. If you look at the figures for Dublin in terms of postal districts, you get some districts that are nearly 100% and you get other districts that are 30% and less. Location is also very, very important. I mean, there are no universities in a line from Dublin to Galway north of that line. There are counties that have neither a university nor an institute of technology. And with the cost of universities and college, going to college these days, for some parents, living away from home for a son or daughter is just not financially viable. There's also an interesting statistic which actually came from the CAO, not from the, from the colleges, which is that about 10% of those who applied this year, and therefore roughly about 10% of those who get in, had repeated the Leaving Cert, and they're actually counted a second time. They were counted when they originally went. And in many cases, they're the ones who actually have the financial wherewithal, because when you go back a second time, not only do you have to pay the registration fees, but you have to pay the full first year fee, which could be about 8,000. So all kind of factors go into it.
I want to ask you finally, Brian, about this report on the front of the Irish Independent that parents plans are being drawn up to give parents more information about their child's school. Could cover everything from teaching standards, student achievements, to how well the schools look after their pupils' health and well-being, but not to include exam results. What do you think?
Well, that decision on the exam results has been made by the minister many, many years ago, and it's in legislation. And effectively, what it's doing is denying the newspapers the opportunity to do what they would like to do, which is today publish the progression rates from this year's Leaving Cert. And the feeling is that it would drive students towards those schools that are perceived to be successful, which are probably the ones, you know, the fee-paying schools, the ones with, you know, high social class participation, and would drain those. And I kind of agree with that policy to a certain extent, but I do believe totally in transparency. I believe that schools would succeed when there is total clarity, and I think parents have an entitlement to that, and I don't think we have anything to hide in the education sector.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for coming in this morning. Brian Mooney, Education Analyst and Guidance Counsellor at Oaklands College in Dublin. It's 2:30 to 9.